Welcome to the UFO Files Show with your host, Jerry Pippin.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the UFO Files, another one of the Phoenix Light specials, and we have William Warwick on the phone from Virginia. But we're dealing with Phoenix, and William, you might explain that to everybody, exactly what is happening. You're promoting a Phoenix Lights conference, and it'll be on March 31st and April 1st there in Glendale, Arizona. And we can talk about that in great detail in a moment, but tell me how you got involved with the Phoenix Lights. And welcome to the show.
Well, thanks a lot, Jerry. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about this. Actually, I got involved with this because I was a witness to a boomerang on March 12, 1997 in Norfolk, Virginia. And for 6 months after that, well, maybe not quite that long, for a number of months after that, there were no other sightings that I was aware of in Virginia. And quite frankly, it really just upset me. And when I found out about the boomerang sightings in Phoenix, I really began my investigation in earnest, figuring that there was enough material out in Phoenix that I might be able to figure out what was really going on and maybe perhaps what had happened to me the previous night on March 12th.
Now, the reason, and we'll get into more about that, than what you saw in Norfolk and what happened there, but the breaking news, I guess, this week would have to be the fact that former Arizona Republican Governor Fife Symington III is recanted what he did originally. You remember that originally at a press conference he had somebody come out in a costume and made fun of it all, but he suddenly has changed his mind. He's come forward and said, "Hey, I believe it. I saw it." Isn't that right?
Well, he's actually, you know, gone on record now. Well, actually, the real story is that he went on record back in 1997. The documentary producer of Out of the Blue, James Fox, kind of got a quick interview with him before he was going to trial. If you recall, he was on trial for various alleged charges. And James Fox was able to get a quick interview with him, I believe, on the courthouse steps right before he went in. And a concerned citizen from Phoenix had recorded a tape recording of some questions that she would have liked to have had asked of Governor Symington. And it's my understanding that James presented that tape recording to Governor Symington, and he responded to the questions on video. And basically said that, you know, he was going to, I believe, get the Arizona Safety Police or organization or whatever, whoever's in charge of that particular thing for your state to investigate it. And then promptly, you know, entered the courtroom. And then, of course, I believe it was the next day, after a 6.5-hour judge's chamber conference inside the courtroom, after that interview, came up the next day and held the press conference that we're also familiar with the guy dressed up in an alien costume.
Now the trial, we don't want to confuse our audience. The trial had nothing to do with UFOs.
No, completely separate subject, which he was later, I believe, the charges were dismissed by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
So, but this was just an opportunity for James, who produces this movie, this DVD, to catch him.
Yeah, he was actually, you know, as part of other UFO cases that he was investigating, he wanted to, of course, investigate the Phoenix Lights. And so he had this videotape testimony, but, of course, after Fife Symington came out, you know, the next day with that, the whole alien costume debacle, you know, he wasn't going to print it. You know, it just make him look stupid. Of course, Governor Symington would have denied it. So he's had this tape, this video, this evidence that Symington has had this experience, but he's been sitting on it, you know, for the reasons just given. And so now that Symington, you know, Governor Symington, for whatever reason, has come forward, and I truly believe to set the record straight. I've talked to Francis Barward at length about this issue, and the impression that I get, I'm not from Arizona, I don't know the man personally. All I know is what I've read and the people that I've talked to that were friends with him at one time before all of these things went down. And I think he's a straight shooter, and I think the government coerced him And a lot of other people that, like for instance Mike Fortson, who was at the trial, said that, you know, when he went into that judge's chamber for 6.5 hours and came out, he was white as a ghost, you know. And then, of course, the next day he announces this whole thing and does a 180, a complete 180, on the whole issue of the UFO subject. And, of course, now we can maybe understand why. Even if Governor Symington to this day will not come out and say anything about that, I think that there's enough evidence to show that something happened to make him do that, to change his mind.
Well, I mean, you mentioned Frances Barwood, and she's a city council member at that time, and she faced a lot of flack for asking innocent questions, if I remember correctly.
She just said in a council chamber, you know, can we look into this? That was it. You know, no conspiratorial talk, nothing crazy. It was just a very simple question by a duly elected, duly authorized, representative of the Phoenix government. And she was ignored, completely ignored. You know, if she had said, I want to find out about the murder case of, John Bonet on whatever day, you know, there would have been an answer to it. She could have asked any question she wanted to ask a question about, and she would have gotten a response on it, but she was completely ignored. And if you don't know Frances Barwood, you know, she's just one of those people that you just don't do that to, you know? And she did not take that answer at face value, and she said, you know, she looked into it. The only elected official, other than maybe Jimmy Carter, and possibly President Clinton, who actively tried to, you know, find out what was going on in a public manner.
Now, Frances Barwood's going to be at your conference.
Yes, she is. She certainly is, and she will be available, for questions from any other witnesses. Again, the conference is for the witnesses. It's called Witness 2007, and, if you're a witness to the Phoenix Lights, the events that happened in Phoenix before, during, or after March 13th, we'd love to hear from you. You know, we're going to have a professional videographers on staff that will be able to videotape your testimony and set the record straight. You know, your governor, your former governor, is going on the record now to come out and support you, and I guarantee you that there will be many other people who will come forward to tell their stories as well.
Now let's tell everyone where this conference is, so people who are listening who have had the experience. I mean, this thing was huge. A lot of people have seen it.
Frances Barwood said that she personally spoke to over 700 people who witnessed these events. And she got a little over, I believe, 1,200 phone calls. She was only able to return about 700 of those to speak to those people in depth. So, 700 people did not see flares. 700 people did not see just lights in the sky. A very good portion of those, almost by my account, two-thirds of those sightings, occurred at right, beginning as early as 6:55 a.m., according to Peter Davenport of Norfolk. I mean, of New Fork.
Now you're talking about 6:55 a.m. on the 13th.
6:55 p.m.
Okay. I want to make sure. And I guess it came down from northern Arizona across the state?
That's correct. From, I believe, the earliest reports were from right around the southeast corner of Nevada, northwest corner of Arizona. And the reports, you can literally go to the National UFO Reporting Center website and correlate the times and the dates and the descriptions and follow this object. You know what I mean by that?
Yeah, one of our staff did that, and it looks like it comes right out of from somewhere around Area 51, straight on down.
That's correct. And in fact, the day before on March 12th, which kind of sort of ties into the sighting that I had of a boomerang in Norfolk, Virginia. There were a number of sightings that described, lights that may or may not have been connected to a larger object, which was cruising towards Area 51.
Yeah, and we're going to get into your story about the Norfolk sighting and what happened there a little later in the program, but we're talking about the conference right now, and I want to get back to Symington, too, here, but the conference is where?
It's going to be in Glendale, Arizona, at the AT&T Auditorium, which is adjacent to the Thunderbird Executive Inn and Conference Center. All of our information, directions, how to buy tickets, hotel reservations at the Thunderbird can all be obtained at www.thenorfolkinstitute.com. Norfolkincident.com, and Norfolk is spelled N-O-R-F-O-L-K, as in Norfolk, Virginia. And all the information that your listeners, if they're interested in coming and giving their testimony, is on that website, and they can check it out.
And on this page where this program can be heard at any time, that we have a link to your website. You would advise people to contact you ahead of time, if possible. Yeah. I'm talking about people who have a sighting. Obviously, the people coming to the conference probably would want to make a reservation.
Yes, they can call the again, all the information is on the website. There's a number that you can call for the Thunderbird Executive Inn. If you mention Eyewitness 2007, they will give you a discount in case you want to stay for both days. The content of both days is going to be split up so that if you do come, if you can only come for one day, you're still going to get a good chunk of information, as well as a really good presentation of the information that's in my book and that we'll probably touch on tonight. Although I have over 800 pages of information, which have to be culled down to, you know, who knows, a 300 or 400 page book, but about half of it is on my website, and we could spend 4 or 5 hours talking about that tonight, and I don't think we can get through it all.
Yeah, I understand that, but you're urging really anyone that maybe even be a little reluctant to think about it. And if they're a witness, they can show up there and probably be heard.
You know, for 10 years, the skeptics have had their day, and they've been, you know, telling everyone that, you know, this is just flare drops, and the government has dropped these most recent flare drops in Phoenix trying to confuse people. You know, the government doesn't want the public to know any more than they do. And they will and have done anything as you know, governor of here, Arizona, hopefully someday maybe even to attest to,
Yeah, it'd be interesting to find out why he changed his attitude like that.
You know, Jerry, that's the story here. That's the story. The story, for me, is not that that he's coming forward and saying that he saw a solid boomerang or triangle-shaped object in Phoenix at 8:30 p.m. For me, the story is, why did he deny it, and why did he do the 180-degree turn? That's the story. And, you know, I don't know if he will be able to tell that story. And so the reason why I'm coming out and saying this now, you know, maybe publicly for the first time, is because I've talked to a lot of people that know him and felt betrayed when this happened and couldn't really quite understand why he would have done something like this. And, you know, perhaps it's better left for people other than Mr. Symington to postulate as to what might have been the reason for his action.
Well, he's a good friend of McCain, Senator McCain. McCain still hasn't come around. I mean, as far as saying he's seen anything.
Well, the whole UFO subject for 60 years has been the political equivalent of the touch of death. You know, I can't think of any politician of any stature at a national, or local national level, or federal level that has ever taken a stance on this, with the exception of Jimmy Carter, who, as my understanding, went to good old George Bush back when he was DCI, Director of Central Intelligence, and asked about the UFOs, and if it's my understanding, Mr. Bush's reply was, you don't have the clearance for that.
Yeah, and of course, people probably don't understand how Bush could get away with saying that to the president, but the point was, it was on his last day in office. And so, as the new, I believe it's Stansfield Turner, came in.
Correct. Who must have died mysteriously in a canoeing accident. Isn't that true, or am I confusing that with one of the other DCIs?
Let's talk a little bit about this Phoenix lighting, a whole effect. We're really not talking about all of the lights at 10 o'clock. We're talking about something huge at around 8:30, right?
Part of this, yes, correct, absolutely correct. Part of this, I believe, the disinformation that has gone on, or let's say misinformation, and give the government a little bit of a break, is that, you know, it's called the Phoenix Lights. You know, all of the attention has really been focused on events that happened around 10 p.m. in Phoenix. The vast majority of the sightings that I've seen, that I've investigated, and the witnesses that I've talked to, occurred, you know, around sometime between 8 and 9:30 p.m. And these are solid objects, boomerang-shaped objects, absolutely immense, mile-wide proportions. And all of those witnesses, Mike Fortson, Captain Trake Johnson, who's a former Northwest Airlines retired airlines captain, who's certainly qualified enough to know what a...
You named a couple of interesting names there, and we're going to take a break, and let's come back and talk about those two. And they're both going to be at the conference, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I have the full support of Mike Fortson, former Councilwoman Frances Bowers, Captain Trake Johnston. This is a conference of the witnesses, by the witnesses, and for the witnesses.
We'll be right back. Don't go away. I'm Jerry Pippin. We're doing the Phoenix Lights on the UFO Files.
Major sighting here.
On the 13th of March, weird happenings in the skies over Phoenix recently. And no one seems to be able to explain what it was.
And now, suddenly six amber orbs in a row, totally equidistant from each other, massive span across, pop up.
People say they saw strange lights.
A series of strange bright lights seen over the skies of Arizona gets a lot of people wondering.
There are another 10,000 Arizonans who saw the same thing.
Eyewitnesses who saw it say it's like nothing they've ever seen before.
Last night, shortly after 8 p.m., hundreds, maybe thousands of Arizonans reported seeing a triangular-shaped object with three to
thousands of people saw more than stars in the night sky.
The mystery remains unsolved and controversial.
There was nothing there.
The award-winning documentary by Dr. Lynn Kutar, The Phoenix Lights, is now available from shockjerrypippin.com. Order now. Supplies limited. Dealing with the Phoenix Lights, the Phoenix Lights Conference, of course, in Glendale, Arizona, on March 31st and April 1st, and we'll give you more details about that. This is a conference, of course, for people who are the witnesses, which is interesting. Welcome back to the show, William Warwick, who is promoting the conference and has quite a history in UFOs, and we'll get into some of that in a minute, but at the break, Bill, it's okay if I call you Bill.
Absolutely.
You mentioned some interesting people here that are going to be there. Mike Fortson, who has been on a mission, really. He's been looking for 10 years for photographs of this giant boomerang. Mike is from the same place where Symington lives.
He's a former Phoenix resident.
Yeah, I was just wondering if there was any connection there. That you could say?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Mike might correct me on that, but Mike followed political stuff for a long time. I believe, I don't know if he was a political affairs officer or what in the Navy, but I could be wrong about that. But let's just say he followed a lot of political maneuverings. Okay. So when this whole thing broke, and he was a witness to the 830-ish boomerangs. That were also reported by Captain Trake Johnson later on at 10:22 p.m. Just like me, it's what Peter Jennings said, seeing is believing, and it's so true because you can tell people till you're blue in the face. I saw a 600-foot wide boomerang photo over my head, blah 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 blah. But until you see it, it's hard to believe. And that's the thing that really, if you talk to the witnesses, okay, any of the real witnesses of the boomerangs, not the lights, because the lights could be anything. To be honest with you, and no offense to any of the people that saw the lights, because I personally have seen glowing objects that are round and that are that sort of amber color. I've seen them down here in Norfolk. We've had other sightings of other people that have seen these things going back 50 years in Norfolk over the same area that I saw the boomerang. So I don't mean to put those witnesses off, but yes, Mike went on a mission to find other witnesses of the boomerangs that were solid objects. And try to correlate and corroborate, sightings and stories.
Captain Trake Johnson, you mentioned him. He's a pilot, a commercial airline pilot.
Retired, yes, correct. Northwest.
And why is he important to the story?
Because there are a couple of reports from military or professional, what I would call professional observers. What I mean by that is, and no offense to any old ladies that are out there, but the difference between an 80-year-old woman who sees something in the sky and a professional retired Northwest Airlines captain with 10,500 flight hours and multi-engine aircraft is like night and day. Now it doesn't mean that the old lady can't see the same thing as a professional airlines pilot, but certainly...
What you're saying, Bill, is what they use in the justice area in court. Witnesses have certain weight, and professional observers like pilots, police officers, military people carry a little more weight.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, it's just like in my particular case, I was a former, I was a senior member of the Civil Air Patrol, and we did search and rescue missions at Taunton Airport under the command of Anita Raymond. And, you know, I was the spotter. I had what was called Eagle Eyes, 20/10 vision, and I sat in the back of the plane, and it was my job to be able to see things from far away, parts of aircraft, identify the parts, and help to guide the pilot and the co-pilot, you know, to a downed aircraft. And so, you know, people who are around aircraft a lot, they know what the flight characteristics are, they know what the flight envelopes are, they know, you know, what collision lights are, and ELTs, and EPIRBs, and all that stuff. And so they're familiar with all of the flight characteristics of normal aircraft, and you know, I would say some abnormal aircraft. And certainly Trey Johnson can testify to that. This was nothing like anything ever seen or anyone on this planet has ever seen.
We will get to your experience in Norfolk here in just a second, but there's a guy on your list here looking at your PR information I don't know. Tim Lay.
Tim Lay and his whole family.
Is that how do you pronounce his
I
name?
I believe so.
L-E-Y?
I believe so, yep. Tim Lay and his whole family, his wife and his, I believe, his, I think it was his grandson at the time. Could be wrong about that. I haven't talked to Tim in a couple of, about a month and a half. But they witnessed, and as well as other people in his neighborhood, this huge boomerang-shaped UFO float over their head. They were just completely at a loss. And he's even gone on record, and I have the videotape testimony, not the videotape, but the audio interviews that he gave, you know, from 10 years ago, where, you know, even he will say that, you know, at first, you know, it's unbelievable, and he would never have said to someone who came up to him and said, you know, I saw a UFO, he wouldn't dismiss him out of hand. But until you see it, you just really can't appreciate the magnitude of it. It changes your life forever because you suddenly realize that everything that everyone has told you is impossible is not only possible, it's real.
Let's talk about your sighting the night before, I take it.
Yeah, March 12, 1997, that's correct, at 9:08 Eastern Standard Time in Norfolk, Virginia.
What happened there, there was an involve of a crash of a troubleshooter...
Troubleshooter 615.
Yeah, now, is that a helicopter?
Yes, that's Special Operations Flight Troubleshooter 615 went down on March 13, 1997 at 11:19 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 80 miles off the coast of Norfolk. If you correlate 11:19 p.m. to Arizona time, basically what it means is that Special Operations helicopter flight crashed into the Atlantic Ocean at around exactly the same time as the height of the Phoenix Light at 9:30-ish Arizona time on March 13th.
Now, this troubleshooter 615 helicopter, when it crashed, there were some fatalities.
Yes, four very experienced airmen and pilot, co-pilot, and the two guys in the back died in that crash. Yes, there were fatalities involved with this. And the story, you know, the interesting thing about, there's a lot of interesting things about this story, but we can get into if you want, but this story was quashed. There was no media about this crash for 6 months until it was published in December of 1997 on the front page of the Virginia Pilot, and then we never heard another peep about it again. It almost is reminiscent of some of the stories that took months and months to come out involving the Phoenix Lights. And one has to wonder if there was a direct...
a correlation or whatever, but well, there were no deaths in Arizona, were there?
If you include the A-10 pilot that just decided to...
Now, we're talking about Craig Button.
Talking about Craig Button, that's correct, who decided on April 2nd, 1997, Craig Button was about to go on his first live bomb test, live bombing range. He activated, we would assume, his ground radar, and no one ever saw him alive again. Disappeared. It took 20 days for the government to find him. And allegedly, he crashed his plane into Craig's Peak over New York Mountain, about 800 miles from Davis Monthan Base. Now, the thing that's really, you know, again, bizarre about this whole case is that the government's explanation for the flares, of course, the Phoenix Lights now, okay, is that the visiting Air National Guard, A-10 Squadron, from Maryland, dropped the flares, you know, various reports say 8 o'clock, but some of them say 10 o'clock. Apparently the government doesn't really know. You know, you have to wonder, did Craig Button know something that he shouldn't have known?
Now, was Button from that Maryland National Guard?
No, he was from Davis-Monthan.
Okay.
He was from Davis-Monthan, which is of course, in Phoenix, you know, very near Phoenix. But he, you know, you got to understand this, he took off, he broke formation 2 weeks after the Phoenix.
There's some things about this thing... That trouble you, and I think we need to flush it out a little bit more. Tell people he crashed into, ultimately, a mountainside.
That's correct.
And I think they ruled it was suicide.
That's you know, whatever. Do you recall the Iowa incident where they said that sailor was gay and they were having a gay love affair and this, that, and the other thing, and then years later they found out it was total bull? Do you remember that, where the turret blew up on the USS Iowa?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, they did the same thing to Craig Button. The story came out the same way. First it was suicide, and then he was, you know, repressed homosexual, and then it was because his parents were Jehovah's Witnesses. It's total bull. His sister got on, I've never met her sister. I hope to God that she contacts me and she hears about this to set the record straight about her brother. I think her brother was a hero. I think he was, I'm going to go on the line here, I think he was killed. Okay, I think he was murdered, and there are a lot of things about this flight that make absolutely no sense whatsoever.
Tell me a couple of them.
Well, first of all, the bomb, he had four MK2 500 dumb bombs. A dumb bomb is just what it sounds like. There's no kind of guidance system on it. They were never found. The wreckage that was found, they never found the bombs. Okay.
Yeah, I remember they kept saying, well, it's down there in the snow someplace.
Down there in the snow, whatever, okay, fine. Okay, where are the bombs? You know, the plane was gone for 20 days. Okay, that's the first thing. The bombs have never been found, okay? 2,000 pounds of high explosives, okay? Let's think about what a terrorist organization some organization could do with that, okay? Now, the second thing that was odd about this whole thing is that, you know, usually, if let's suppose he committed suicide, okay? Most people that commit suicide in such a fashion leave a suicide note. Okay, they want people to know why they committed this crazy act of self-immolation, right? There's no suicide note. Where's the suicide note? He was with his parents, I believe, the weekend before this, in good spirits. From all reports, I don't think he was in control of that craft. I think, from all reports that I've read, that when he hit that ground, when he hit the button for in those craft, usually you're gonna have an air-to-air radar and you're gonna have a ground radar. Okay, you switch between the two of them. They're not constantly on at the same time. Well, if he's going for his bombing run, he's gonna switch his ground radar on. And from the report that I've read, that he was with his wingman. Flying towards the bombing range, they did a radio check, and the last thing anyone heard was that he was getting ready to start his bombing run. Well, when he gets ready to start his bombing run, he hits that button. I want to know what happened when he hit that button, because I don't think he was in control of that aircraft at all. I think that he was dead before he got on that aircraft, and they just took his body and the plane parts and just dropped him on the side of a mountain from a helicopter. Okay. Or he pushed that button, and we don't know what happened after that.
Do you have any clue about what he could have found out there in Arizona?
He knew that the flare drop was bunk.
Okay.
And he wanted to tell someone about it. And the government knew that he wanted to tell someone about it.
We're going to come right back with William, and we're going to talk about some other conspiracy angles. One of them involves President Clinton.
Yeah, well, just before we go, his trainer, Emilio Svoboda, who was his trainer from the same base in Davis-Monthan, died 6 weeks later in another plane crash flying an A-10. His trainer.
Yeah, so you're saying that he probably would talk to his trainer.
Of course he would. The chain of command at any military organization is to go to your CO.
And then another thing that's kind of mysterious is what happened with HAARP. We all know about that. There's a connection to the Phoenix Lights. Don't go away, folks. I'm Jerry Pippin. I want to take a moment to talk to you about astrology. We all enjoy reading astrology in the newspaper, love, life in general. But I want to talk to you about C.C. Stevens. She's in Arizona, and she is really a top-notch astrologer. And she does something a little different, and I think you should know about it. She offers to her customers the Book of You for only $35. Literally, this is a book about you. I don't really have time in a radio commercial to go into all of the details of why you should consider ordering the Book of You. So I urge you to click on this banner that's on this page with the show and check it out. And you can order it for $35. Check, credit card, whatever. This is a great gift idea, too, so order now. This is Jerry Pippin, and we're doing the Phoenix Lights, a special about it, 10 years ago, this month in March. And on the line for Norfolk, we have a fellow who's promoting a conference in Glendale, Arizona, which is right outside Phoenix. And we'll talk about that in a moment. It happens on March 31st and April 1st. William Warwick, when we went to the break, we were talking about all kinds of strange things happening in conjunction with the Phoenix Lights, which to the casual observer would not appear to be connected. But you think somebody needs to connect the dots, as they say. What about President Clinton here? On the surface, it just seems like a random thing that happened at the same time, but maybe not. Tell our audience what stands out about this.
You know, the beautiful thing about this whole case is that you could not write a Hollywood script that would have all the twists and the turns and the intrigue that the real facts have in this case. The Clinton's connection to this basically begins with an event that occurred, alleged event that occurred, in Holby Sound at Greg Norman's Gulf of Greg Norman's house in Florida. At approximately, now the original report that was given to all the news agencies was that President Clinton injured his knee in the wee hours of March 14th, 1997. This would have just been about, you know, 3, 4, maybe 5, 6 hours after the main event continued, okay, and after troubleshooter 65615 went down 80 miles off the coast of Norfolk. However, Peter Davenport from Newfork, who was looking, you know, going over some of the information I had on my website, sent me an email on March 13th, the anniversary, right before I got on Coast to Coast, and informed me that actually the news reports, there are two stories out now. The news story, okay, which is apparently from an interview that Greg Norman gave to Jay Leno on the Tonight Show, is that the events did not happen in the wee morning hours of March 14th, 1997. They actually happened at 11:30 p.m. on March 13th, 1997. Now, what's absolutely fascinating about this is...
Well, it'd be 8:30 in Phoenix.
Yeah. Depending on where you are, I'm not sure if that's 2 hours behind or three.
11:30, 10:30. Well, they don't have daylight savings time. But, of course, they didn't have daylight savings. It wasn't as early as it was this year. So you're right, it'd be 9:30.
Right. So again, when you correlate that with the downing of the craft of Troubleshooter 615 at 11:19 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on March 13th, and then you've now got Greg Norman coming out in this interview with Jay Leno saying on, you know, television that this happened at 11:30 p.m. That means the 10 minutes after Troubleshooter 65 went down and basically at the very height of the UFO flap in Phoenix, allegedly President Clinton injured his knee and had to be rushed away to the hospital. The scuttlebutt is that, you know, apparently we can only speculate on what happened unless Mr. Clinton feels that he wants to talk to the American public and set the record straight, that something happened in Florida, and apparently, you know, the speculation is that, you know, perhaps the they had their own boomerang experience or a threat, and the Secret Service personnel were rushing President Clinton out to a safe area, Air Force One or whatever they had down there at the time. And he blew his knee out. There are some reports that say he never blew his knee out at all. It was just an excuse to get him out of the public's eye under this, you know, alleged knee injury event, so that they could be in hardened bunkers under Bethesda Naval Hospital. You know, the story just gets it's just unbelievable. It just gets more and more
I heard that there was a DEFCON 2 alert, in the first place, what is that?
DEFCON 3, actually, is what it was.
Okay.
According to Bill Hamilton and his sources, Spacecom, which, again, is in Colorado, very near where, in the vicinity of where Craig Button allegedly crashed his airplane, Spacecom issued a Defense Condition Readiness 3 alert. Which put the whole United States military on a sort of a defensive status, you know, anticipating some type of attack. At the same time, and this has been confirmed, Spectrum Astro, I believe it's in Chandler, Arizona, a satellite manufacturer of the MSTY-3 satellite, which is a U.S. Air Force satellite, was disabled by an object which apparently was hovering over it. Well, not in space, it wasn't hovering in space, but some type of object drained its batteries. And the interesting thing about it is that the manufacturer protested that the military, they have a miracle laser that they were developing at the time. The U.S. Army wanted to test fire a laser on this satellite. The manufacturer said, you know, what are you doing? There's nothing wrong with the satellite. The batteries are dead. We can fire it back up, which is telling, because maybe there was something on the satellite that was seen that the Army didn't want anybody to see. There's no other reason to destroy a multi-million-dollar satellite just to test fire a laser.
When we talk about these incidents, there were a lot of things that happened on the 14th, too. For instance, the HAARP, they stopped their test or shut it down or something?
Yeah, you know, it just gets better and better. Okay, as you listeners probably all know, the HAARP stands for High Altitude Auroral Research Project in Gakona, Alaska. This was a ionospheric heater research project, which has other applications speculated by many. Basically, they had developed the program, which is ramping up to a full-size test and deployment of this system. But at the time, in 1997, they had just finished what was called the DP, the developmental prototype. Okay, so the HAARP DP developmental prototype, which is about a quarter size of the full HAARP facility and the antenna systems and stuff like that, went online on February 28, 1997, and went offline on March 14, 1997.
Well, now the U.S. Air Force, they stood down for 48 hours at same time period. Or is that true? Or am I just listening to scuttlebutt that's not backed up?
You're right, but it didn't happen in February. It happened on September 16, 1997. There was three plane crashes in a row. I believe one of them was, I think it was a C-130, collided with a German plane in the middle of the Atlantic. Now, let's think about that for a second, okay? The Atlantic's pretty big.
Yeah, right, and how could they find each other?
Right, and with another country, and then they just happened to crash into each other. And there were two other crashes that happened. In addition to, if you recall, the Baltimore crash of the F-117 stealth fighter bomber, whose wing apparently just snapped off. Well, the scuttlebutt is that it actually hit a cloaked vehicle.
Probably a UFO.
Yes, and there was a lot of evidence. In fact, I have an article from a pilot who took a picture. His name was David Hastings in 1985 of a boomerang-shaped object. It was published in UFO Magazine UK, which is on my website, who basically, you know, felt, or out of the corner of his eye, saw something coming over him over the Mojave Desert where he was flying over in a Skymaster. Couldn't see the object, got his camera out, took two or three photographs. On one photograph, there is a huge black boom. You can't tell it's boomerang shaped because it's going away from the pilot who's taking the picture, okay? But if you look at the air molecules are going over, you know, the middle of the craft, and the refraction of the light off the left and right wings, it's a boomerang-shaped craft, exactly the same size, exactly the same dimensions, exactly the same shape as the craft that I saw in Norfolk, okay? But these guys couldn't see it, okay? It only showed up on the camera.
Yeah, kind of like that story down in Mexico where the thing showed up on infrared and nothing else.
Ah, this brings us back to Troubleshooter 615, okay? The theory that I have about 615 is when the helicopter was coming in to land on the frigate, there was a boomerang that was shadowing the frigate. And they didn't see it till the very last second, because they were coming on approach, everything was fine. At the very last second, they were 40 or 50 feet above the deck, they were higher than normal, they waved off, they did what's called a rotation, and they slammed into the ocean, head nose first, right off the starboard bow of the frigate. And there was no distress call, there was no mechanical failure, they did an autopsy, there were no drugs, there was no medical problems, no heart attack, nothing. So what I believe happened on March 13, 1997, is that that Troubleshooter 615 craft was coming in for a landing on final approach, and who knows what it was doing. Allegedly, it dropped off a SEAL team crew, a four-man SEAL team that was heading back to the carrier and stopping at the frigate for a refuel. The infrared thing is important to understand because from a satellite, if this boomerang-shaped object was traveling sideways, from every indication, upside, up, you know, up, down, left, right, backwards, forwards. I mean, it can go in any direction it wants to. It has, you know, 9 degrees of freedom or 10 degrees of freedom, however you want to look at it. If that one of those boomerang-shaped objects was hovering above the frigate, first of all, the frigate's radar is pointed to the horizon. It's not pointed straight up. Okay. Second of all, from all indications, these things are completely visible to radar. So even if they could see it from a radar that's pointing straight up, which they don't have, they wouldn't see it. However, from a satellite like the Misty 3, if you were looking down, all you would see is the heat signature that would be coming from the frigate, or the heat signature that you would think was coming from the frigate but was really coming from the boomerang-shaped object. So from all indications, I'm going to guess that these objects are invisible to radar, but they are not invisible to infrared or other forms of electromagnetic detection.
There was a gamma ray burst at the same time.
Yeah, the gamma ray burst correlates with the beginning of the HARP CT experiment. On February 28, 1997, there was the first ever optical transient picture. And what that means is the gamma ray bursts occur a couple times a day. They release more energy than us. Some in a few seconds, they release more energy than a whole summer release in its whole lifetime. And on February 28, 1997, for the first time in history, scientists were able to get what's called an optical transient, which is just a picture of the actual light that was coming from from the gamma ray burst. Now, interestingly enough, this was taken on March 13, 1997. It was published in the July edition of Scientific America, and the exact quote, I believe, said that it is a mysterious oblong object, which is between the source of the gamma ray burst and the satellite, which and the Hubble Space Telescope, which was taking this picture, and they had no idea what it was.
We have lots of things to think about here, William, and we still have a quarter hour to go.
I can't believe this is the fastest I've ever gone through this.
We're talking with... I feel like you're a good friend, even though we just met recently.
Yeah, well, you know, it birds of a feather flock together, Jerry.
William Hamilton, he's weighed in on this several times. And so, you're not the only one saying things like this have been.
No, in fact, Mike Fortson just told me today that there was a meteorologist, Schnabel, I believe, in Phoenix, who came to him and told him about the gamma ray burst. And what's very interesting about this, I've talked to Mike, you know, a lot of these things that I'm talking about have not gone unnoticed by the witnesses. And it's very, almost eerily and uncannily reminiscent of some sort of, I don't even know how to explain it.
Yes.
I want to say psychic experience. experience.
Okay.
I'll give you an example. Do you recall Close Encounters?
Sure.
Okay, do you recall when they're in the trailer there with, you know, the guy's supposed to be playing Jacques Vallée and Richard Dreyfuss gets in there and he's just pissed off as hell. You know, the government has no right to do this. You know, you can't keep this from us, blah, 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 blah. And then Richard Dreyfuss gets taken off to the helicopter where they, you know, get taken off to be gassed or whatever. And I'll never forget this. And this is how I can describe this whole Phoenix Lights event and how it relates to my Norfolk incident. It's an event sociological. It's an event sociological. It's a sociological event, okay? The government has no right to stop what's happening. And I don't think they can even if they wanted to. I mean, I think that's part of the reason why they're freaking out about this and they want to keep it suppressed.
Oh, I think you're right about that. William Warwick, we'll be right back.
Do you have a problem with mold or mildew in your home? Well, listen to this. We have found a product you will love. Moldzyme, an effective non-toxic mold and mildew cleaner. Moldzyme is the cleaner, greener way to remove mold and mildew stains. This is a line of completely non-hazardous, non-toxic, and environmentally safe products that gets rid of mold and mildew stains quickly, easily, and safely. Moldzyme contains no chlorine or ammonia, is non-hazardous and hypoallergenic, safe on wood, concrete, and brick, inside or outside your home. Moldzyme eliminates odors and is fragrance-free, an all-natural and environmentally safe way to remove mold and mildew stains that really work. See the complete line of products by clicking on one of the Moldzyme banners located throughout our website, and you'll be glad you did.
The Phoenix Lights Conference will get underway on March 31st and April 1st. William Warwick is our guest, and you're more than just a concert promoter. Well, you know, when I say that, you make a joke about the concert promoter, this is true. You could make more money than you can with a UFO convention.
I am... God, are you kidding me? I think that...
But I have a hunch you're not in it for the money.
I have a very successful design build architectural firm here in Virginia Beach, Virginia. I have a real job. You know, we do contracting, we build houses, you know, we get our hands dirty, you know, and people trust us to do, you know, $200,000-$400,000 room additions. So, you know, the fact that I'm... Yeah, the answer to your question is there's no money in this. I'm putting $20,000 out to invest to, you know, to get everyone to come down. I also want to say that everyone that's involved in this, in terms of the speakers that are coming, like Francis Barwood and Mike Fortson, no one is being paid for this, okay? This is a total volunteer effort. I think it separates this from all the other UFO conferences. I mean, I've had people call me like, you know, I really want to go, but I went to a UFO conference last month and I fell asleep, okay? Well, this isn't what this is going to be like, okay? I'm just a regular guy. I got two kids. I just took my son back from soccer. You know, I'm a baseball coach, you know, and I'm just like 99% of probably everyone out there listening to this show right now. But I had an extraordinary experience, and I cannot stand the fact, and so did thousands of other people in Phoenix and around the world, and I just cannot stand the fact the government is lying to us and making us all look like fools. And if it happened to you, if it happened to your brother or your father or your sister or your mother, and you knew what they went through and the anguish that they went through, okay, you would support them 100%. And that's all I'm trying to do for my fellow witnesses that I don't know, that I've never met. That's all I'm trying to do.
Now, we mentioned all the coincidences, or most of them. There are probably others.
Oh, if you believe in coincidences.
Hey, well, yeah, we can debate that if we want. But for showbiz purposes here on our radio program, we're going to call it that. You know, and in other words, there were lots of incidents that may be related. How's that?
You know, I take that back. I'm a little fired up right now. But, what I do is I'm an investigative journalist in my part-time. That's kind of what, you know, and this is not the only thing.
Well, I can tell you that as an investigative journalist myself. And you know that. You follow the trail. One thing leads to another.
You follow the lead wherever it goes. You know, you don't dismiss anything. You follow it wherever it goes. And if it goes someplace that people don't think, oh, well.
You know, one thing that I, being a nuts and bolts guy, a realist, I had a long time coming to the conclusion or admitting that there seems to be a spiritual and religious element to this UFO stuff, too.
Absolutely. Yeah,
in fact, talking to you, you brought up Edgar Casey.
Sure. Oh, God, yeah, the connection between my sighting and Edgar Casey was really something that I stumbled upon. I mean, literally just kind of fell over. This is very complicated. I'm not sure that we can get through this. But basically what happened is I came across a book published in 1969 by a New Zealander by the name of Bruce Caffey. He had some UFO sightings. He was also a pilot, by the way, okay, a qualified observer. And he had some UFO sightings in New Zealand. And basically he did some studying and some research, and he correlated the sightings and where they were going and where they were coming from. He found a pattern, okay? And he came up with this theory that the UFOs were following what he called a global grid, okay, which was what's called a hyperdimensional force, okay, for lack of a better term, that these UFOs were using to traverse around the atmosphere of the Earth. And one of the stories that he had published in this book called Harmonic Conquest of Space was that his research had found that that the Russians, who did a lot of investigation into psychic energies and stuff like that, he found that they would place their psychics in certain geometric configurations so that their powers would be enhanced. And he speculated that Edgar Casey, who was born in Hopkinsville, Kentucky, at 36 degrees, 51 degrees latitude, north latitude, or 55, I apologize, had traveled all around the country looking for a place where his psychic energies told him was the right place to settle. The last place that he was at before he moved to Virginia Beach was in Dayton, Ohio, which of course is where the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base is now, except he was there in 1925. And he had had a reading that told him that and this is 1925 language, okay, that the energies in Virginia Beach would be like electricity that would pass easier over iron than it would over glass, okay? And there's more than I've got some of the reference material inside of my book, but basically what Edgar Casey was saying in 1925 during this reading was that, you know, Virginia Beach was a special place, and not just anywhere in Virginia Beach, but according to the book that Caffey published, that Edgar Casey moved to the exact same latitude that he was born at.
Yeah.
Indicating that there may be something to the geometric or the geographic, certain geographic locations that would allow some of these tests to take place. Okay? Now here's where it gets really interesting. I said, okay, fine. So what I did is I went out and I got a GPS receiver, because I was curious, because it was the latitude where the Casey Center was that was published in Kathy's book was very near the latitude that I had had my UFO encounter. I said, well, you know, let's just see if there's a connection.
And your UFO encounter was when you were
March 12th, 1997, was 26.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure we're talking about the same
thing. Yeah. So I got this GPS receiver, and I went to go check Kathy's work. Well, lo and behold, what do I find out? Kathy published the wrong coordinates. He was off by 3 degrees. Now, 3 degrees may not seem like a lot, but 3 degrees in terms of actual, you know, miles, it's, you know, 3 or 4 miles, I think. You know, so it's quite a bit off, considering the fact that you can open up an ADC map and know exactly the latitude and longitude of where the Edgar Casey Center is on 67th Street in Virginia Beach, right? So I thought, well, this is really weird. So I contacted Bruce Caffey. I wrote him a letter, and I said, listen, I'm not trying to, you know, rain on your parade or anything, but did you know that your coordinates were off, right? Well, he didn't like that too much, and he wrote me back a nasty email. I said, listen, I'm not trying to disprove you, okay? I think that you're onto something here. And he basically said, go back and look at the book. I went back and looked at the book, and in the chapter where he writes about Edgar Casey, immediately after he give the latitude, right? He writes something to the effect of, I had published this in my previous book, but the government maybe, you know, took the book off the stands, and now I can publish it again. And I thought about that. I thought, well, that's kind of weird. You know, why would the government want him to take his books off the stands and then republish it again? And then, boom, it dawned on me. They made them change his coordinates. All right? So, and that's, and then the base, and then I sent him another email stating that that's what I thought, and then he kind of, you know, he warmed up a little bit. And he said, yeah, that's basically what happened. So, the new coordinates, 36 degrees, 55 minutes north, 43 seconds north, okay, down to the second, which is about 30 feet, by the way. 30 by 30 foot section is the second. And what I found, you're not going to believe this, is that Bruce Cathy, in the very next chapter, after Edgar Cayce, gives the latitude for what he calls a possible harmonic experiment site, okay? Well, that latitude that he lists as 36 degrees, 55 minutes, 43 seconds north is exactly the same latitude where I saw my boomerang in Norfolk in 1997.
Wow.
Yeah.
We only have a couple of minutes left, and I've left out one thing, a phenomenon, I guess, is what I need to talk about that is connected to the Phoenix Lights.
And I don't mean to cut you off, Jay, but there's a lot more to the Edgar Cayce thing that I can really show.
Oh, well, sure, sure. I know. You're going to do a little PowerPoint presentation about that, I think.
PowerPoint presentation, I guarantee you, will blow you away.
And that'll be at the conference itself.
Yep.
The Hale-Bopp Comet. We only have a couple of minutes left. That was the reason most of these people saw this thing, right? They were out looking for the Hale-Bopp.
That's correct, watching the Hale-Bopp Comet, which is a long period comet. I have some of the research that I've done says that this comet was here in 2200 BC, I believe is what it was. And there's a stella called the Narum Stella, which shows two objects. The interesting thing about that is that, if you recall, Hale-Bopp, when it came, there was the whole controversy about it having a possible companion, quote-unquote. And, of course, if you remember the Heaven's Gate cult that committed suicide on March 27th, 1997, just a few weeks after the Phoenix Lights, they're the ones that said that there was a UFO behind the comet as well, which kind of gave it a whole fringe element that probably it really didn't need to have.
Yeah, we could talk about a lot of other things. One of my favorite coincidences or events or something that's synchronistic is the idea that Federico Pena was appointed to the Department of Energy as the head of it.
From the reports that I've read, Federico Pena was swiftly approved and appointed to be the new Secretary of the Defense of, Department of Energy. Approved on March 12th, and he took office on March 13th, 1997, and he gave a closed circuit speech to all DOE employees on that morning.
In the morning of the Phoenix Lights that evening.
That's right, in the morning at 10 a.m., I believe. The scuttlebutt with that, of course, is that, you know, UFO researchers have been saying that the Department of Energy has been the organization within the United States government that handles all alien or UFO-related subjects, so... you've got a changing the guard, so to speak, taking place.
Right.
On March 13th, again, you know.
We have 30 seconds left. William, give us a little commercial for your conference.
If you have seen the Phoenix Lights or the boomerangs, and you're a witness to these events in Phoenix, please come to this conference. This conference is for you. You will have a chance to have your testimony videotaped. We will take all of the testimony that we get. It will be delivered, hand-delivered by myself and my executive producer to the National Archives in Washington, whether they want it or not. And this is your chance to tell your story and let the world know what really happened in Phoenix.
Now, you have a book out?
I put the book off.
Okay.
The money that I was going to use to publish the book, I decided to put it off until after the conference so that I can include it.
So you put the money into the conference.
Correct.
Watch out for a book coming out one of these days by William Warrick. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. This is Jerry Pippin, our producer, of course, for this show, and post-production editor is Jane Swartley. Until next time. Cheers.
Oh, my darling, my darling. The year was 1970 when Jack Blanchard and Misty Morgan released their first big single hit, Tennessee Birdwalk. For the first time in the history of music, this 45 RPM single becomes available to the public in the form of a mouse pad. Made of high-quality quarter-inch rubber, this fabric-covered 8-inch mouse pad delivers your mouse a very smooth ride. For only $9.95 plus $2.50 shipping and handling, your mouse pad will be rushed via USPS first-class mail. Simply click on the happy little mice and be directed to our ordering page. Hurry while this limited time offer lasts.
It's Tennessee Birdwalk.